Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear from a management specialist. My guest today says dozens of companies around the country are upending the traditional rules of management that have been placed really since the beginning of the 20th century into a new management philosophy that puts employees first so they're better able to be creative and productive on the job and serve a business's customers. Organizational psychologist David Berkus explores 13 new management practices that he says expose traditional management philosophy as not only misguided, but actually counterproductive. His new book, Under New Management, How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual, examines how outlawing email, losing the standard vacation policies to have unlimited vacation time, making salaries transparent, and ditching performance appraisals are unlocking more productivity and performance on the job and increasing morale and employee satisfaction. David Berkus is an associate professor of management at Oral Roberts University and is a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Bloomberg Business Week, and the Financial Times. He's also a popular corporate speaker. His new book, Under New Management, is published by Houghton Mifflin. David Berkus, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Your new book, Under New Management, I think you refer to it as sort of the 21st century style of management among some of the most innovative companies, and it really turns what we've known as traditional management on its head. Where did you first start learning about some of the principles you write about in this book?
Yeah, it's a good description of it, and it's really kind of where it started. So my first book was called The Myths of Creativity, and it dealt with what are the misconceptions that we have about how the creative process works, how does innovation actually happen versus the stories that we tell ourselves about how it happens. And in doing that, you kind of discover these little sort of quirky things that are just a little bit different, right? Like a Google or 3M, 15%, 20% time, those type of things. And that kind of put these ideas on my radar. And then over a couple of years, I'm watching as you read all these stories about unlimited vacation or pay transparency or things like that. And you know, I'm seeing them through the lens of organizational psychology. That's my background. And I'm not seeing anybody talk about, well, here's the actual reason they work. They're actually grounded in study of human behavior. So that was really kind of the impetus for the book, is I think someone needs to explain that these policies, they sound fun for sure and they sound great, but they also work because they're grounded in human behavior and I believe representative of a larger trend. We designed the rules of management back in the Frederick Taylor days for how to run a factory or an assembly line, and most of us aren't doing that anymore. And if you're doing that more knowledge work, as Drucker would call it, or what I would say even more just creative work, the rules for what's the best way to manage and lead that work are very different.
Is there a lot of tensions in creative organizations where it's based on creativity and innovation, where you have these very traditional management rules? You're talking about Frederick Taylor, who's the guy who invented the 21.5-pound shovel, because that was the exact amount of weight that a worker could ideally, you know, shovel stuff with. And it was that sort of minutia and sort of, here's your job, you do it, and then, you know, somebody else takes the rest of the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, the assumption in Taylor's day and in a lot of the early management theorists' day was that the job of management was to figure out what the tasks were and then to measure and make sure that they were done. The job of labor, that was the second tier, wasn't to think. We didn't need them to think. We just needed their body. Well, now, most of us in a knowledge work organization, we're hiring you for your brain, right? And so the managing you like we used to do in that day with those different practices, it kind of falls apart because it's still based on that assumption that management knows best, labor doesn't. Well, most of us, I mean, I think anybody that's ever laughed at a Dilbert comic is really laughing at the idea that they know a little bit more about how to do their job well than does the person in charge of supervising them. And that's the reality of kind of where we go, is that there's a really good chance that management doesn't know your job as well as you do. So they have to default to trust. They have to default to autonomy and a lot of other things in order to get your best work out of you.
I was struck by one of the second principle in your book Under New Management, and it's putting the customer second and putting your employees first. That flies in the face of every mantra we've heard, especially in the service industry for the last 30 years. But you have service industry people who are saying, no, we put the employees first, the customer second. If we make the employees happy, they're going to make the customer happy.
Right. And that's exactly the philosophy. It's, you know, that idea that the customer is always right. That's a valid philosophy. It's a valid goal. The challenge is when in trying to serve a customer, you end up throwing a frontline person under the bus, or you end up limiting their ability to take action to actually satisfy the customer. At that point, there's a divided loyalty there. They feel like the customer is both the actual customer of the business and their manager. And when you're asking them to satisfy both, there's a tension there. The companies that really actually get the highest levels of customer service do so because they put the frontline employees first. What Vinette Nayer of HLC Technologies would call the value zone. Any zone that touches the customer is the value zone of a company. We put that value zone first so that the people in there can put customers first and feel like we have their back, we'll support their endeavors, et cetera. So the end result is still customer service. It's not, we don't need customers. It's we care so much about them, we realize the only way to make them happy is to make the people that deal with them happy too.
Yeah, there was one company that basically made everybody behind the frontline employees who are dealing with the public accountable to the frontline employees.
Yeah, so this was in the book. This was HLC Technologies, a technology consulting and vendor. And what they basically did is they flipped the hierarchy on its head. You know, when we draw the traditional org chart, we have lines and boxes, and we think about reporting relationships, which sends this message that the lower levels are accountable to the higher levels. And what they sought to do was really flip it around and say, no, if you're the ones dealing with the customers, we're accountable to you because you're accountable to the customer. And even creating sort of an internal customer support system where if somebody in that value zone needed something, they could start a ticket and the ticket would go through the organization before it got whatever need they had. And the only person that had the authority to close the ticket was the person that opened it, not just the manager deciding, well, we've satisfied this claim, which really does send that message of, no, we're accountable to support you because you're accountable to the customer.
So does this change the typical phone conversation where you're talking with a frontline person and they see your problem? And they say, well, I'll have to run this up to my boss or, you know, you're moving up the chain. Does that change that equation where that frontline worker actually has the authority to say, we're going to get this fixed and, you know, I'll send this up and it's going to happen?
Yeah, so exactly. And in some cases, some companies are putting limits on, you know, there's a famous axiom about the Ritz-Carlton company, and I think it's $500, but there's some dollar amount that they say, if there's any problem the customer has and it's within this amount of money, you just go do it. You have the free autonomy to go do it. You don't need to ask for us. But then even when they do need to ask for something out of management, there's an expectation that within reason it'll get done, not, oh, I don't know if this is going to happen because I need to get approval. It's, I got to go through a couple steps to get this, but we'll get this fixed.
Now, that idea of putting employees first, is it mainly just in interactions with the public or does it go further than that?
So the data and most of the research has been done on service-based organizations, so organizations where there's a regular recurring customer. In the book, I look at Wegmans, the supermarket chain, which is to some extent a recurring customer company, but to another, it's very much each individual transaction sort of stands alone.
This is a supermarket chain.
This is a supermarket chain, yeah, exactly. And you see there's some research done on other supermarket chains, which is, again, is sort of a hybrid between a one-off interaction sales process and a long-term customer interaction. You see a very similar result. The attitude and the feelings of the employees on that front line dramatically change this experience, even if it's just one time inside of a supermarket.
And in Wegmans' case, they're doing things like, if you're going to work as a cheesemonger, they may send you to Europe to really learn about cheese.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're going to make the decision on what department you're in based on kind of what you're passionate about, what resonates with you. Then we're going to invest in you to really grow your knowledge, not just because we're going to teach you how to love cheese, but we know that somebody who's looking for that perfect, you know, plate, that perfect assortment of cheeses for a party, they're going to benefit from actually getting to interact with somebody who knows what they're doing, not just somebody who knows, well, according to this pictogram, here's what cheeses go on what shelves, and I know nothing about what they taste like. I just stock them.
And I assume that goes to all departments of the store. So if you're working in produce and you're trying to source local produce, they're going out to
farms. You're going out to the farms. And yeah, and if you're in the bakery, you're going to, you know, France to learn about how, learn from bakeries, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, but it pays off. And anybody who's ever been to a Wegmans knows. I mean, there are petitions in almost every city that doesn't have one to bring one to them.
Now, how can they actually put a figure on the bottom line for that all that investment in their employees?
I can't. I'm sure they can. They're a privately held company, so they don't necessarily share a lot of that data. What I tried to do is pair that with some of the academic studies, especially in supermarkets around this concept of the service profit chain that have been done. You definitely do see an ROI.
Now, one of the very first thing in the book, which this is probably something a lot of people think about it from time to time, but at the same time, they're saying, how could we do without it? And that is, you say, we should outlaw email.
Yes, everyone's love-hate relationship with email, right? We love it because we're kind of always connected. We hate it because we're always connected, right? And that's really a challenge of the medium. We sort of readily adopted this tool without really thinking about what it means. You know, the telephone, when that came into the way business was done, it was still not all that intrusive. Sure, it was on your desk and it was ringing all the time, but if you left your desk, no one expected you to answer it. This is really the first technology for communication that we adopted that actually required us to sort of be always on. I mean, even in the original days of cell phones, the battery died in like 2 hours. So there was an expectation that even your cell phone wasn't turned on all the time. Well, this is one that really changed that game. And a lot of companies are looking at it as a tool for communication and finding it lacking, but also as a source of distraction, both on the job and off the job. It's hugely damaging.
Emails happens on vacation. It happens on evenings, weekends, and there's all these distractions in an employee's life.
Right. And so how much rest and relaxation are you getting? Are you coming back actually recharged? And then the other thing is, you know, are you actually, you're getting that email on vacation. You are definitely, like almost by definition, not the right person to be handling that problem at that time. But because you're available, we're still going to kick it to you.
Yeah. And companies are doing a whole range of things from completely outlying email. And you say, well, how does the company communicate? They come up with these sort of shared collaboration tools where you decide to go in and participate or not. I assume if they're outlawing email entirely, it goes back to paper? Memos?
Well, no. So they're not outlawing electronic communication, but a lot of the companies that are going full on outlaw email are turning to a little bit more modern collaboration tools. You know, the off-the-shelf equivalents would be something like Slack, or I know inside of Salesforce there's a technology. The ones that work the best are usually customized by that company. And the big difference is they're very similar communication tool, except that they are not pushed. They don't come and interrupt you. It's when you decide to open that window, turn on that communication stream, then you're engaged in it. When you decide to shut it off, you're off. Now, that's not what most companies that I say sort of fall in this outlaw email are doing. Most of them are actually just putting limits on it, either certain hours during the day or definitely, you know, evenings or weekends, we don't do it, et cetera.
Is Volkswagen the one that does 30 minutes before work starts till 30 minutes after work ends? You know, email works during that time.
Right.
If you're 31 minutes after work ends and you send an email, it's not going to be sent until 30 minutes before work begins the next day.
Exactly. Yeah. They shut off the servers so that, and I actually really like this solution because everybody's life is a little bit different. And so you might be that person that, you know, I come home, I leave work early, I grab the kids from school, get them, and then when I put them to bed, I turn it back on and I do another hour and a half of work. And that works for you. The challenge is if you're sending that email at 11:30 at night, you're sending this subtle message that you expect other people to be doing it too. So I love the idea that it just stays in your outbox, even if you want to clear it out, and then boom, when the day starts again the next day, that's when it gets sent out.
Now, one of the other intriguing ideas that some companies are using is paying people to quit. Now, at first glance, when I saw the heading, I said, oh, we're talking about buyouts once people have been there for a while, and maybe no. This is for your brand new employees. They go through the orientation period, as I guess, assume at some point during that orientation period or in that first 6 months of work, companies are offering them a buyout to leave. So explain this philosophy.
So this idea started with Zappos, the online retailer, most famous for shoes, but they sell a variety of different stuff now. And theirs was after primary training. So you come into primary training, whatever your job is, it's about 4 weeks of primary training. The first 2 weeks are you're on the phones doing customer service because that's their claim to fame. That's what they want to be known for, is fanatical customer service. And so you go through that, and then you go through your actual content training. And then at the end of 4 weeks, you get the offer. And the offer is, you know, you've seen our company, you know what our culture's like, you know the level of excellence in customer service that we ask for. If you don't feel like this is up to you, we'll pay you, I think it's currently $4,000, but, you know, for a call center employee, that's about a month's salary, if not a little more. We'll pay you that to leave. We would rather learn that right now than continue to invest in you, train you, and 6 months down the road after very poor performance, say, you know, this isn't working out. We'd rather you admit it's not working out now. Now, other companies have taken that. When Amazon.com bought Zappos, they actually migrated that policy, but they don't do it primary training-wise. They actually do it yearly. So in certain divisions, not every division of Amazon, every year you get a memo, and it's the title of the memo is, please don't take this offer. So it's not like we're trying to get people to leave. But what we're trying to do is make it easier. If you really aren't happy, if you really don't think this is going to work out, we'll make it easier. We'll almost sort of give you a paid severance, not for being laid off, but we'll help you go, we'll pay you to go find a new job, because it works better for everybody if you're not here.
How does that work out? I mean, do they find that they have a far more satisfied workforce?
Yeah. So first, very few people ever take the offer. And Zappos is something like 8% of people that are given the offer actually take it. So that's the first thing. And that's really what triggered my interest, because I'm sitting there going, okay, well, if 92% of people get this offer and don't take it, Well, then what goes on in their head? And that's where, you know, psychologically we see confirmation bias at play. When we make a decision, we start to seek out information that confirms that we made the right decision. So, you know, if I offer you $5,000, $4,000 to quit and you don't take it, well, now subtly and subconsciously, you're looking for reasons why that was the right decision. It actually increases engagement, you know. The other thing is that, like I said, those people that would probably be the detractors, the de-energizers, et cetera, we're making it easier for them to part before they do a lot of damage. So you see dramatic increases in morale because primarily the people that might be dragging down others are gone, but also because everyone's sort of selling themselves on why this was worth passing up the money for.
My guest today is David Berkus. He's an associate professor of management at Oral Roberts University and a nationally known author and management specialist. His new book is titled Under New Management, How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual. And there's about 10 to 15 trends that are upending traditional management philosophies. Another one is making salaries transparent. A lot of places, if you know, you reveal your salary, that's grounds for dismissal, you know, going back to the mid 20th century. But in this day, when we're talking about gender equity and pay, equal pay for equal performance, it seems to make maybe a little bit more sense. What is the philosophy behind making salaries transparent?
So I have to say off the bat, this was not the one I was expecting to be the crusader for, right? You know, I myself, when I found this policy and started looking into the research behind it, et cetera, I made probably, maybe not 180 degree turn, 167 degrees, et cetera. I get how uncomfortable that idea is. But, you know, I saw a lot of, like you pointed out, in industries and in companies where salaries are transparent, you see dramatic reductions in the gender wage gap. Believe it or not, in companies that have transparent salaries, you see higher levels of morale. And it begs this question of, like, what's going on here? Why is this the case? And what we look at from a psychology standpoint, there's a theory of motivation called equity theory that says that we are constantly comparing our efforts and our rewards to other people in the company's efforts and rewards. And when things are equitable, not necessarily equal, but equitable, you know, you work a 10 and I get paid a 10 and I work a 15 and get paid a 15, everybody's fine. When you work a 10 and get paid a 15, now we've got a problem, right? And so what we find is that in a secrecy condition, people are terrible at judging how hard other people are working. We've always known that. And terrible at guessing what they get paid. And so the end result is, there's no surprise, there's dysfunction, there's comparisons, there's jealousy, there's backbiting. And interestingly, those are all the reasons why we argue for secrecy. You know, that if we had transparency, all of these things would happen. No, those things are happening anyway. So clearly that strategy is not working. Maybe if we give people the actual data, here is what they're getting paid and why they're getting paid that, we turn the attention to a system that now, you know, if you have a problem with my salary, you have recourse and we can have a discussion about, is this a fair pay system? And I have to say, that's really the first step. Is I think most companies are at the point where they strive to have a fair pay system, but it's not known to most people. So it's no surprise that they then attack it like it's unfair that it allows all these inequities.
Sounds like the critical part is the why a person is getting paid what they're paying.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, we're grown-ups. We're okay with the idea that someone makes more money than us as long as we can see that they're providing more value or working harder or something like that.
Now, there's another theme in a number of these suggestions and things companies are doing to change traditional management policies, and they're all very employee-based. It's almost like I think of the 80s and 90s and 2000s as how much productivity can we squeeze out of our workforce? How can we make it as lean as possible? All of a sudden, there's this sort of switch that we need to treat our employees as, you know, as a respected part of the team. And everything from losing standard vacation policies to close open office floor plans, mm-hmm. which I think is... You know, that's one of the things. It's like it sets the haves from the have-nots in a lot of companies, where if you have a door, you know, you're absolutely a have.
Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it. I mean, I look across a lot of these practices afterwards. The interesting thing is a book's never sort of finished. It's just published. And then right. When other people read it, they write you in, they email you, they give you their perspective, and you start to notice things that you didn't even notice when you were writing it. And one of the things that I kind of noticed after the fact is that there's 13 practices in the book, lucky number 13, and all of them, for the most part, are practices of elimination. In other words, sort of we had this thing left over from a different era, and it was blocking, or from this era that we thought was working out, And we found that it was actually blocking people from doing their best work, so we eliminated it. You know, the vacation policy, people are going down in the level of vacation that they're taking. Maybe it's the idea that we're treating it like a currency. Maybe it's we're encouraging people to hoard it. What if we just said, we trust you to take whatever vacation you need, and opened that up? What would that do? And so really, it's an experimentation of elimination. And it's kind of interesting to me because, again, like you said, it's definitely employee-focused because it's what do we need to eliminate to let employees do their best work.
Yeah, and the open office plan, yeah. You know, that became the big rage in the, what, the 90s?
Yeah, so, I mean, both...
And the cubicles become just an object of derision now.
Right, yeah. So I think in both dot-com bubbles, especially the one that burst, but also, you know, the one that we're still kind of in and just hasn't burst yet, we saw a rise in open offices that, you know, we love to tell the stories about, oh, that allowed serendipitous encounters and increases in collaboration and those things. And that's true. The truth is most of these startups turned to it because it was cheap and because they were bootstrapping and trying to do more with less. And then that had some side benefits that were a little positive. And then everybody wants to the conversation today is everybody wants to know how to feel like a startup culture. So we just go look at the office and go, oh, well, if we mimicked them. And really, I think there's an increased trend towards open offices that's probably more driven by the cheap factor than the actual increases in creativity, et cetera, because all of those studies are offset by a wealth of research that shows, well, there are also increases in stress levels. There are increases in distractions. There are increases. Actually, my favorite study is open offices have more people calling in and cashing in sick days, which either means they're legitimately getting sick more often or they're just sick of the office that they have to work in. And, you know, as I travel around and speak about these ideas, I run into so many people that say, yeah, and this is actually why I disappear and go to the library, or I have a membership at a co-working space. I need somewhere I can hide because I'm stuck in this office where I can't focus. So what a lot of the more savvy companies are finding now is that the best workplaces provide the coolest term I've heard for it is a palette of places, a variety of different types of environments that you can go to depending on the type of work you need to do at that moment.
My guest today is David Berkus, Associate Professor of Management at Oral Roberts University and the author of the new book, Under New Management, How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual. One of the things I found interesting, and you used one of our local companies as an example, is taking sabbaticals. And we think of this as the purview only of higher education, but companies are now encouraging their employees to take sabbaticals. Now, sabbaticals in the higher education world usually involve personal enrichment or academic enrichment to help them be better effective teachers or learning more research about their own area of expertise for a professor. How's this working in the business world?
Yeah, this is one of those weird, you don't go into this type of work expecting to find a lot of ideas from university life that work well in for-profit world. But this is one of the ones that do. So there's a couple different things at play. Like you said, there's the personal enrichment idea. I mean, the truth is there's a lot of experiences, trips, et cetera, that people who work in a standard, you only get 2 weeks vacation and 5 sick days or something like that, just can't have because of the level of time investment required. So whether it's learning a new skill or traveling to a new place or things like that, we're depriving them of those experiences. And the interesting thing about creativity is we see the most creative ideas happen when somebody grabs an idea from an unrelated field and brings it back to our field, which is why in universities we sort of encourage this. The other things you see I think are really interesting is, you know, any increase in sort of vacation and downtime is going to lead to an increase in or decrease in stress and an increase in productivity when people come back. What I think is most interesting for most organizations is it allows you to stress test your succession plan. So in other words, if you've got management tiers, especially that you're encouraging to take sabbaticals for a month, 2 months, 3 months, et cetera, somebody's got to fill in that work. And so it allows you to take a look at that person that you're thinking, well, they're probably the next generation of management for this position. Let's go ahead and test them. If it works, great. We know that our succession plan is working. If it's not, we found out while it was still reversible, instead of that first person leaving and replacing them with this new talent that ends up not working out. That's a much harder lesson to learn.
McDonald's uses that. You said that McDonald's is sort of successful. In fact, they found a lot of people that they didn't really think of as being able to take the next step that they found, hey, when they filled in for somebody who was on sabbatical, we found new talent.
Yeah. McDonald's was actually the first company, the first at least big national known company to play around with sabbaticals. And it was kind of shocking. I was not expecting that. I was expecting some Silicon Valley tech company, something like that. But yeah, that's exactly what they found. The people who had to step up to get the work done while that person was on sabbatical, we ended up seeing aspects of them that we didn't see in the normal system, so we could actually promote them.
Yeah. You mentioned Quick Trip, too. Quick Trip here locally offers sabbaticals.
So Quick Trip offers one. You have to work there for a pretty long time, but they definitely offer one.
But as you mentioned, you said a lot of times people are starting when they're like 18 or 19.
Right. So it's not, it's
like a mid-career.
Yeah. When we hear 20 or 30 years, we think that's, the end of your career. But if you started when you were 18 and you worked your way up through the organization, it's a kind of a mid-career sabbatical, definitely.
Yeah. So when you look at these 13 tips, should companies be thinking of, okay, how many of these is an overall philosophy? Is it just a few things that can make a difference depending on the individual company? What exactly?
So I've yet to find a company that's doing all 13.
Yeah.
I've come pretty close.
Are there some companies that are doing a whole bunch of these?
Yes. And again, I think the philosophy behind them is actually the one that I'm more concerned with hoping spreads. And that's first this idea of elimination by improvement from eliminating bureaucracy that's blocking people. And the second is that realization that the nature of work has changed. And we took a lot of ideas that were written for industrial work, factory work, assembly line work, and even the early stages of knowledge work. You know, we used to joke about paper pushing. People don't talk about that anymore because we have a little bit more creative work environment in most organizations. And that fundamentally means the way we manage that work has changed. So that's really, you know, my encouragement is not, you know, take this idea off the shelf and implement it. But hopefully here's a bunch of different companies that are true to that philosophy. You might find something in there you can implement exactly. But what my hope is and my concern more is that we look at our own company and go, okay, what were the things that we assumed would be useful for managing the work our people are doing? And are they actually useful? And if not, we need to change them.
Now, you mentioned it says, you know, a book is never finished. It's just it gets published. Have you heard an interesting management philosophy or technique since the book is published?
So I've heard a couple interesting ideas. I haven't had the time to sort of research them enough. What I'm more encouraged by is I've heard of more companies that are doing these sort of same things. So, you know, I've had people reach out to me from, oh, yeah, we do this no email thing, or we have a totally virtual workforce, or we have no managers, et cetera. So I'm encouraged by, I thought I knew how widespread they were, and I'm finding it's a lot wider, which is good. And then, you know, my hope is I can add my voice to that and get these ideas to push even further.
You know, we were talking about vacation, sabbaticals, changing vacation policies. Getting back to the outlaw email, one of the things I thought was really interesting, and it's a true fear when people take vacation is you almost feel like you have to keep up with your email while you're on vacation, because when you get back, you're going to be swamped. There's a company that basically has a policy of when you go on vacation, a notice goes up on your email saying this email is going to be deleted because this employee's on vacation. You need to resend it when they return to work on such and such a date.
Yeah, Daimler's mail on holiday program in Germany, and it's a really interesting policy. It's exactly that. It's the standard autoresponder we're all used to seeing, except underneath the return date is, and these emails will be deleted. So here's the person to contact while I'm away, or resend it on that day. And it helps with that deluge of first day back emails for sure. And what's funny is shortly after writing the book, I sent an email to another author friend of mine, and I got her version of the same thing. She basically said, I'm finishing up a book. So I'm not checking this email account. When I get back, I'm just going to Control-Alt-Delete. So send it back to me on, I think it was August 1st, and I'll get back to you.
Right. The name of the book is Under New Management. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you again so much for having me.
Organizational psychologist David Berkus is an associate professor of management at Oral Roberts University and the author of Under New Management, How Leading Organizations Are Upending Business as Usual. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.